Well, welcome everyone. Oh, that
good.
Gets your attention, right? Welcome everyone to Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm Rob Olson, and I'm privileged to be the MC tonight. I want to thank everyone for coming out. We meet on the second and the fourth Tuesday of every month, coming up through May, so we take a sabbatical in June, July, and August. If you do not have our spring schedule, it's on our website, www.philosophersforum.edu,
Philosophersforum.org.
I should know that, but I don't. Anyway, I just want to welcome everyone here, and I just wanted to briefly mention, we have several officers here. David Drum is Vice President, Kim Sauter, who's our AV sound guy. Jack Youngkin, back there is our treasurer. If you haven't paid already, the payment is $2 if you're a student or $5 if you are a non-student. So if you didn't see the sign up beforehand, then please do so after our presentation. And if you want to become a subscriber, then you can pay $35. That'll take you 6 months. And so we can put that on the books. So if you're interested, that's a great way to save some money. And if, just a reminder, make sure you pay your bill afterwards. Every once in a while, someone might forget. We are a non-profit organization, and so we don't care to take on that cost. So if you can make sure that you take care of your bill and tip your waitstaff generously, we'd appreciate that. If you want to sign up to get our updates on our meeting, you can do so www.meetup.com, Dallas Philosophers Forum members, and then you can get on the Meetup list. Did anyone here find out about us through Meetup? Okay, so several of us. Several of you all. Okay, that's great. Okay, so last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. Tonight's presenter is Dr. Nathan Zhang. Rhymes with fun, right?
Okay.
J-U-N. He is an assistant professor of philosophy at Midwestern State University in Wichita Falls. So we really appreciate him driving out here today. That's about a 2.5 hour drive. We really appreciate you driving out here. That's quite a haul, particularly with Dallas traffic. He's also the philosophy program coordinator at Midwestern State University. He earned his PhD in philosophy and literature from Purdue University and has a master's in philosophy from Penn. His area of specialization includes social and political philosophy, 19th and 20th century continental philosophy and ethics. And I visited with him briefly, and I would proffer that he knows more about continental philosophy and anarchism than anybody in Wichita Falls. Maybe even in Dallas. Maybe the whole DFW area. So we're really fortunate to have him tonight. I think you spoke about 5 years ago here to wide acclaim, I believe. So Dr. Jung is the author of several books, three of which deal with anarchism. And a lot of focus on continental philosophy and ethics as well. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Nathan Zhang.
Hi, as Rob said, I spoke to the Philosophers Forum a couple of years ago, and it was a lot of fun, but on that occasion, I spoke for a really, really long time. I just wasn't really paying attention to the clock, and I want to try to avoid that tonight, in part so that there's time left over for questions, but also because I have kind of a long drive back to Wichita Falls this evening. So without further ado, this paper is entitled On Philosophical Anarchism. In this essay, I argue that what has been called philosophical anarchism in the academic literature lacks any real relation to the historical anarchist tradition, and for this reason ought not to be considered a genuine form of anarchism. As I will demonstrate, the classical anarchism of the 19th and early 20th centuries can be distinguished from other political theories, including contemporary philosophical anarchism, in two important ways. First, classical anarchism involves a principled rejection of domination and oppression, and by extension of those institutions and relationships, including but not limited to the state, which are taken to be incorrigibly dominating or oppressive. And second, classical anarchism recognizes a moral imperative to abolish incorrigibly dominating or oppressive institutions and relationships. In other words, classical anarchism is coextensive with what has been called political or practical anarchism. Lastly, I argue that defenders of dominating or oppressive institutions must take the challenge posed by classical anarchism seriously by engaging substantively with actual anarchist positions. The term philosophical anarchism was popularized in the 19th century by the American individualists Benjamin R. Tucker, Victor Yaros, and various other writers associated with Tucker's journal, Liberty. For Tucker and the Liberty Circle, philosophical anarchism referred chiefly to a practical rather than a theoretical orientation. Like revolutionary anarchists, the philosophical anarchists rejected the state on principle and, like socialists of all stripes, stood opposed to the exploitation of workers under capitalism. Where the philosophical anarchists differed significantly from their more radical peers was in their preference for peaceful, evolutionary approaches to the abolition of oppressive institutions, for example, popular education and the creation of alternative institutions, over the violent revolutionary approaches advocated by the likes of Bakunin, for example, propaganda by the deed and armed insurrection. Over the course of the past several decades, the anarchism of the 19th and early 20th centuries has seldom been discussed in mainstream philosophical literature. In contrast, a certain kind of philosophical anarchism, represented prominently by Robert Paul Wolff's In Defense of Anarchism, which was published in 1970, and Robert Nozick's Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which was 74, among others, has received significant attention. It must be noted, however, that the use of the term philosophical anarchism in these contexts differs significantly from the original meaning cited above. In these cases, philosophical anarchism refers merely to a principled skepticism toward the legitimacy and authority of states, which is generally articulated in two forms. A posteriori philosophical anarchism, which contends that all existing states are illegitimate, and B, a priori philosophical anarchism, which contends that states are illegitimate by definition. The most well-known defender of a posteriori philosophical anarchism in recent times has arguably been John Simmons at the University of Virginia, who contends that, one, political institutions and relationships are legitimate if and only if they are the result of voluntary consent, and that, two, all existing states are illegitimate insofar as they fail to satisfy the first criterion. Robert Paul Wolff, in contrast, has defended a form of a priori philosophical anarchism, according to which states are necessarily incompatible with individual moral autonomy. Although both the a priori and a posteriori forms of philosophical anarchism typically assert that citizens of illegitimate states lack general political obligations, not all philosophical anarchists understand illegitimacy in terms of the lack of general political obligations, nor are all philosophers who recognize the lack of general political obligations committed to philosophical anarchism. Unlike Tucker, contemporary philosophical anarchists are usually silent on economic issues, although a few are committed to broadly libertarian economic perspectives. The literature frequently makes a distinction between philosophical anarchism and political, also known as strong or practical anarchism, a view which claims not only that states are illegitimate by definition, a la a priori philosophical anarchism, but also that the legitimacy of states obligates or at least permits us to abolish states. Although philosophical anarchism on the one hand and various forms of more or less radical egalitarianism on the other have enjoyed varying degrees of support in the literature, political anarchism is seldom defended. More commonly, it is simply ignored or dismissed as crackpottery. As Paul McLaughlin notes by way of summary, quote, according to the academic stereotype, political anarchism is theoretically negatory. Anarchism is all about instinctive rebellion, understandable and occasionally justified and illuminating, perhaps, but ultimately irresponsible, immature, and unrealistic, and therefore better suited to popular youth culture than refined academic circles. There is no clear explanation for this, but one obvious problem, it seems to me, is the paucity of Anglophone philosophers who actually bothered to engage the historical anarchist tradition. Indeed, even these philosophers have tended to overlook the fact that anarchism is a living tradition of political theory and practice that has existed in various forms for at least two centuries and is probably much older. As a result, prejudice and caricature abound, but there is precious little understanding of what anarchists really believe and why they believe it. The few philosophers who have done their homework have consistently failed to approach the anarchist tradition on its own terms, which is to say they have gone looking for a formal academic tradition of the sort to which Marxism gave rise. Not finding one, they abruptly conclude that anarchism has nothing to offer philosophically. This is a mistake, however. In the first place, anarchism is not an ism in the same way that externalism, cognitivism, or naturalism are isms, that is, an abstract descriptor used by academic philosophers to position themselves within philosophical debates. The term anarchism, along with the theoretical and practical orientations it designates, not only predates Benjamin Tucker's philosophical anarchism, but also the various academic discussions of philosophical anarchism mentioned above. Furthermore, because the anarchist tradition has always been, and continues to be, revolutionary and propagandistic in character, even its most ambitious theoreticians tended to write with practical goals in mind, it is a mistake to compare anarchism to formal political philosophies such as Rawlsian liberalism. Reading anarchist texts often requires modes of interpretation and critique that are very different from the kinds used in conventional academic philosophy. For these reasons, it is eminently appropriate to inquire, one, whether philosophical anarchism as discussed in the contemporary literature has any real relation to the historical anarchist tradition, and two, if it does not, whether philosophical anarchism ought to be called anarchism at all. Many philosophers have answered two in the negative without explicitly taking up one. Chaim Gans, for example, argues that philosophical anarchism, presumably in comparison to political anarchism, is a toothless doctrine devoid of any real practical implications. In response, John Simmons writes, quote, "It is a matter of only terminological interest whether we call philosophical anarchism a form of true anarchism or instead argue that it is misnamed. I have located the essence of anarchism in its thesis of state illegitimacy. Others might argue that its essence is rather advocacy of active opposition to and elimination of the state, in which case philosophical anarchism would be an unhappy name for a still perfectly defensible political philosophy," end quote. Although Gans's judgment is accurate in my view, the problem isn't just that Simmons' brand of anarchism is practically inert. Rather, it is that Simmons' characterization of anarchism, and indeed the prevailing understanding of anarchism in contemporary philosophical literature in general, lacks any genuine connection to the historic anarchist movement, let alone to the philosophical anarchism of Benjamin Tucker, a position which had a legitimate place, however marginal, within that movement. This is not merely a terminological issue, but a historical and philosophical issue as well. Michael Friedman has argued at length that ideologies like Marxism, liberalism, and anarchism should not be viewed as fixed, invariable belief systems so much as languages whose core concepts evolve and change over time. And I have a long quote here from Friedman, which I'll skip over for the sake of brevity. As I noted previously, anarchism is not an academic abstraction, but a dynamic historical tradition comprising at least two centuries worth of thought and practice. If Friedman is right, then it is possible to identify, at least approximately, the conceptual parameters of this tradition, even as those parameters undergo evolution and change. Although all the major anarchist thinkers are socialists, anyone with a passing familiarity with the history of socialism, and especially the First International, recognizes that the abolition of private property is scarcely constitutive of anarchism as such. Even if anarchists and socialists are able to acknowledge an affinity with one another on the basis of their shared rejection of private property, this obviously does not imply that all socialists are anarchists. In the same way, although all the major anarchist thinkers, not just a handful of academic philosophers, as Simmons suggests, are committed to advocacy of active opposition to and elimination of the state, none of them regard such advocacy as the conceptual foundation of anarchism. I do not doubt that anarchists would acknowledge a certain affinity with non-anarchist anti-statists simply in virtue of their shared rejection of the state. But this scarcely implies that all anti-statists are anarchists. For classical anarchist thinkers, on the contrary, anarchism entails a rejection of all dominating and oppressive social, economic, and political institutions and relationships, not just the state, where rejection is understood not just as an abstract moral judgment, but also as the concrete advocacy and pursuit of their abolition. There is little doubt, moreover, that classical anarchism, including Tucker's philosophical anarchism, is political or practical in character. In fact, the distinction between political anarchism and philosophical anarchism is not clearly demarcated in the tradition, but only emerges in the rarefied context of 20th century academic philosophy. Thus, even if anti-statism is an important component of the conceptual morphology of anarchism, both as an ideology as well as a political philosophy, anarchism is nevertheless not reducible to anti-statism. All of this suggests that Simmons's use of the term anarchism is idiosyncratic at best, or incorrect at worst. I have a long detour here where I present an argument that's intended to show this, but I'll skip over that as well. On the most charitable interpretation, Simmons's account, alongside other mainstream philosophical discussions of a posterior anarchism, rests on a kind of composition fallacy in which a necessary but derivative part of anarchism, namely the belief that all existing states are illegitimate under some description or other, suffices for the whole of anarchism. Although anarchists do believe that all existing states are illegitimate under some description or other, the same is true of neo-Nazis, and presumably most everyone who adheres to extreme or outmoded political ideologies, which was the point of the argument that I skipped over. To refer to all such individuals as anarchists strikes me as more than terminologically idiosyncratic. It is rather a straightforward category mistake. Again, believing that no legitimate states exist under some description or other may be a necessary condition for being an anarchist, but it doesn't come close to being a sufficient condition. Anarchism involves, and has always involved, much more than principled skepticism regarding the legitimacy of existing states, and for this reason, the answer to two above is unequivocally no. The term philosophical anarchism as used in mainstream philosophical literature is an egregious misnomer, which ought to be abolished in favor of a more accurate descriptor. Okay. Here I go on to talk a little bit about a philosopher named Paul McLaughlin, who has, in my view, has put forward one of the more plausible definitions of anarchism. I ultimately reject it here, but I might as well mention that McLaughlin defines anarchism as a principled skepticism towards all forms of authority, including but not limited to the authority of the state, which seeks to eradicate illegitimate forms of authority. Okay, that comes much closer to the historical tradition, but I end up rejecting it anyway, largely because I don't think that anarchism is reducible to skepticism, principled or otherwise, towards authority. And I am saying that this suggests that it's not authority per se that anarchists regard with skepticism or more commonly reject outright, but rather any relationship or institution which, whether accidentally or by definition, operates by means of domination or oppression. As I will argue, it is precisely domination and oppression, and not authority per se, that are the authentic enemies of anarchism. Okay. If my account thus far is correct, then what has been called political anarchism, the strong and typically a priori anarchism of Proudhon, Bakunin, Kropotkin, Emma Goldman, Tucker, and others, qualifies as genuine anarchism, whereas most of what has been called philosophical anarchism appears to be a counterfeit, which reduces anarchism to a kind of principled anti-statism. Although political anarchism has not been taken seriously in literature, and although this is surely a result of its being so consistently misunderstood and misrepresented, this may be partially attributable to legitimate etymological considerations. Anarchism comes from the Greek anarchia, which can be translated roughly as the state of being without a ruler. Anarchia, in turn, comes from anarchos, which can be translated variously as without chief, ruler, leader, or authority, without a top or head, or without a beginning or first cause. Taken by itself, this could lead one to reasonably assume that anarchism is solely concerned with the rejection of political authority. Although anarchists do believe that the authority of the state is arbitrary, oppressive, and, for these reasons, immoral, anarchism is not solely or even chiefly a principled rejection of the state. Rather, it is a principled rejection of all political, social, and economic institutions and relationships, including political authorities, which are founded upon domination and oppression. I have some quotes here from Proudhon and from Kropotkin and so forth that kind of make this point. That is the point that there's all different kinds of institutions and relationships that that are oppressive, including the state, but also including the church and capitalism and so forth. Countless other examples could be provided. Suffice it to say that for anarchists, what matters is not just that certain institutions and relationships happen to dominate and oppress people, but that, one, domination and oppression are necessarily immoral, that is, morally wrong in themselves. Two, certain institutions and relationships, including but not limited to political authority, are necessarily dominating and oppressive, thus necessarily immoral. And three, necessarily immoral institutions and relationships ought to be abolished in favor of morally legitimate relationships and institutions. In order to analyze these claims, we must first examine what is meant by the terms domination and oppression. To be kind of judicious here. So first, domination. Although domination has been discussed extensively in the literature, there appears to be a general consensus that it consists in living under the arbitrary power of another, having to confirm one's actions to a will external to one's own. Iris Marion Young, named as one example, defines domination as, quote, institutional conditions which inhibit or prevent people from participating in determining their actions or the conditions of their actions. Here we must distinguish between people who are otherwise capable of rationally and responsibly determining their actions or the conditions of their actions, and those who are not, for example, children or the mentally disabled. It is not clear to me that inhibiting or preventing people of the latter sort from participating in determining their actions qualifies as domination in the relevant sense, insofar as there can be and often are morally legitimate reasons for engaging in this sort of behavior. Thus, it is not necessarily arbitrary. On the other hand, there are prima facie grounds for thinking that people of the former sort should not, as a general rule, be inhibited or prevented from participating in determining their actions or the conditions of their actions. This is not to say that there aren't or couldn't be morally legitimate reasons for such activity, but only that such reasons must exist in order for the activity to qualify as non-arbitrary. Let us stipulate that, first, X is autonomous at some time, T, if she is capable of rationally and responsibly determining her own actions at T. Second, that X is dominated at T if and only if X is autonomous at T, X is prevented or inhibited from participating in determining her actions at T, and there are no morally legitimate grounds for inhibiting or preventing X from participating in determining her actions at T. Third, that an institution or relationship is dominating if it involves general conditions that unjustifiably prevent or inhibit persons from participating in determining their actions. These definitions are intended to make clear that domination is not just a matter of inhibiting or preventing persons, whether they are autonomous or not, from participating in determining their actions, but of doing so without morally legitimate reasons, that is, arbitrarily. Because there can be and often are morally legitimate reasons for exercising this kind of power over non-autonomous persons, we may assume that they are generally not subject to domination. Anarchists in the tradition take one for granted, as when Bakunin describes an autonomous individual as one who is, quote, competent to deal not only with the management of his or her personal life, but with its most important context, the social context, end quote. They also take for granted that domination is usually a matter of exercising arbitrary power over autonomous individuals, as described in 2, and that institutions, for example, the state, are dominating to the extent that they exercise such power, as described in 3. The question of whether exercising power over autonomous persons is or could be non-arbitrary, that is, whether there are or could be morally legitimate reasons for inhibiting or preventing autonomous persons from participating in determining their actions, is generally open for political philosophers. Not so with anarchists, for whom the answer to this question is always no. Different anarchist thinkers argue the point differently, but the general idea is that the exercise of repressive power over an autonomous individual is always arbitrary, and for this reason always qualifies as domination, which is morally illegitimate by definition. If this is so, it can only be because autonomous persons are not just capable of determining their own actions, but are, in some sense, morally entitled to do so without interference from others. When Smith dominates Jones, she is preventing or inhibiting Jones from managing her own life. In other words, she is violating Jones's moral right, not just her ability, to think and act for herself in accordance with reason and conscience. Insofar as autonomous individuals ought to be able to direct their own actions without interference from others, and insofar as domination necessarily prevents autonomous individuals from being able to direct their own actions, it follows that domination is morally wrong by definition. Anarchists generally contend, again in different ways and for different reasons, that individuals are morally entitled to direct their own actions without interference from others, precisely because autonomous individuals are equally free, that is, equally entitled to freedom from such interference, by definition. From this, it follows that no autonomous individual or group of autonomous individuals is morally entitled to dominate any other autonomous individual or group of individuals. Okay. I then go on to talk about oppression. I'll skip over this. But the way that I discuss oppression here is as this particular kind of domination, which also is how it tends to be discussed in the literature. It's in general, we can think of oppression as a form of domination in which the dominator benefits in some way from harming the dominated, right? So, and so there's kind of an asymmetrical sort of relationship of power, right, where in exercising power over you and preventing you from participating in your actions and so forth, I also harm you in some way, right, which is not, reducible to just denying you your autonomy, but I also, in harming you, benefit from some way, proportionately. I also talk a little bit here about authority, and I'll skip over this, but I'll just note very quickly that, in general, contrary to popular belief, it's not authority per se that anarchists reject, but certain kinds of authority, right? Forms of authority that are generally referred to as opaque or closed authorities, right? So the difference might be, between the authority of the state on one hand, right, which you have to, obey simply because of who it is that's, who's issuing the relevant directives, versus the authority of the teacher, right? Where, you might have a good reason to, believe what the teacher or the expert is telling you or whatever, but if you wanted to, you could go beyond the authority of the expert or the teacher and confirm his or her teachings for yourself. So that's the relevant difference. I mean, in general, anarchists are going to be opposed to forms of authority that are, are arbitrarily sort of repressive, which closed authorities typically are. Okay, so classical political anarchism is opposed to the state in as much as states are, by definition, opaque authorities that dominate autonomous individuals. It may be understood, accordingly, in terms of what A.J. Simmons calls a priori anarchism, the belief that states are incorrigibly dominating, thus illegitimate by definition. At the same time, classical political anarchists hold that incorrigible domination, thus illegitimacy, of states provides a moral reason to oppose or abolish them, a position which Simmons calls strong anarchism. It must be reiterated, however, that the state is only one of many institutions which qualify as incorrigibly dominating or oppressive, and for this reason which anarchists oppose. Their real enemy is not the state, nor any particular social, political, or economic institutional relationship, but rather domination in general. And I have a little section here where I just sort of note that one way of understanding the difference between, say, anarchism on the one hand and liberalism, say, or Marxism on the other, is that both liberalism and Marxism, sort of take it for granted that some kind of domination is inevitable, that it's wrong, perhaps, but it's sort of necessary. It needs to be tolerated for the sake of achieving other substantive political or economic ends, right? So, in the orthodox Marxist tradition, a lot of thinkers like Lenin will say that, to the extent that our goal is to abolish private property and exploitation, we'll tolerate, a certain amount of, political domination in the form of the dictatorship of the proletariat for the sake of achieving that end. In liberalism, it's this, the Lockean tradition, it's similar, right? To the extent that we are capable of enjoying the greater share of our freedom under the yoke of the state, then we're entitled morally to contract together to form a state, even if the state is inherently dominating, okay? So anarchism differs from those traditions in that it says, no, domination is never justified for any reason, okay, in general. Lastly, let's see if I can work in a little bit of this here. political, okay, this is important, political anarchists don't deny that incorrigibly dominating institutions such as the state, capitalism, and patriarchy are capable of providing some benefits to society as a whole, including to the individuals they dominate. Otherwise, it's kind of hard to see why they've been around for so long. So, for example, states provide citizens with safety, order, and security. Capitalism protects even the most exploited worker from starvation, and so on. In many cases, these so-called benefits are outweighed by significant disadvantages to the dominated, which are proportionally advantageous to the dominant. For example, the more women are disempowered, the more social power accrues to patriarchy, the more citizens are repressed, the more political power accrues to the state, and so on. In other cases, the benefits may be taken to outweigh the disadvantages. For political anarchists, however, what matters is not what individual institutions do or are capable of doing in spite of being dominating, but the fact that they are dominating. Political anarchists reject institutions and relationships that are based on asymmetrical distributions of power. They believe that such institutions and relationships are morally unjustifiable, regardless of the benefits they provide or are capable of providing, because, again, domination and oppression are morally wrong in themselves. Now, in the tradition, I mean, the recognition of the moral illegitimacy of dominating institutions is generally taken to be, you know, a sufficient reason for seeking actively to abolish them, right? And failure to do so on the part of people who recognize the moral illegitimacy of states would be seen as a kind of complicity with the state. One could certainly argue that. But one could object that that sets the bar too high. Suppose, for example, that one could immediately abolish the state simply by wishing it. Such a wish obviously would not eradicate all dominating institutions at once. In fact, the sudden disappearance of states would arguably make at least some of these institutions even more dominating and or oppressive than they are at present. For example, the abolition of state-sponsored labor and environmental regulations, or public education, or social welfare programs would facilitate greater and more egregious exploitation of workers and the poor by capitalist firms. At least that's a possibility. If an anarchist refused to make this wish, he or she would, in effect, be working to protect the state. However, it is not clear that there is anything wrong with this, particularly if it turns out that the sudden abolition of the state would increase the overall balance of domination existing in the world. On the contrary, limited support for or toleration of certain forms of domination might be justified to the extent that this reduces the overall balance of domination in the short term, or if it is part of a long-term strategy to reduce and eliminate domination and oppression. This objection strikes me as sound. Even if it is true that anarchists are perforce obligated to take active means to abolish domination in general, this does not imply an all-or-nothing commitment to abolishing all such institutions at once. Anarchists have always acknowledged the existence of what Patricia Hill Collins calls the matrix of domination, a network of independent and mutually irreducible forms of domination, which are nonetheless capable of intersecting and colluding with one another. There is no question that capitalism, for example, derives much of its power to oppress from the state, where the state in turn relies upon capitalism for much of its military power, etc. If the goal is not to eradicate this or that form of domination, but rather domination as such, and if it is true that the capacity of a given institution to dominate depends wholly or in part on its relationship to other institutions, then it is surely justified in some instances to support or at least tolerate some dominating institutions for the sake of reducing the overall balance of domination in the short term or for the sake of eradicating domination in the long term. What forms this support or tolerance might take or how much of it is appropriate are tactical questions which have historically been the subject of rich and spirited debate among anarchists. So, for example, one of the big debates among anarchists in the late 19th century was whether anarchists should be involved in 8-hour day struggles in the labor movement, or whether they should even be involved with the labor movement, right? And the majority opinion was, well, you know, as long as we have a state, right, for the foreseeable future, we ought to strive to make the state sort of serve the interests of working people as much as possible. So anarchists, you know, traditionally played a role in the various labor struggles that led to the 8-hour day and to workplace safety regulations and so forth. So that would be an example of this. So conclusion. If I'm right, then a unifying foundation of historical anarchist theory is the principle of rejection of institutions founded on domination, then there are at least two ways in which philosophers could and should engage substantively and honestly with genuine anarchism. First, by asking whether, why, and to what extent domination is, in fact, immoral. And second, because this is not taken, you know, for granted by everyone. And second, by asking whether the institutions which anarchists identify as incorrigibly dominating are as anarchists describe them. You know, it could be, for example, if you think of modern liberalism, for example, modern, this is what's so absurd about calling the President of the United States a socialist, for example, right? In the best tradition of modern liberalism, the most progressive elements in our Democratic Party simply want to reform capitalism in a way that minimizes the harm that capitalist exploitation does. Not to eradicate it, right, just to sort of rein it in. So there are plenty of people, including many like left-wing sorts of people, who would disagree that you know, capitalism, for example, or the state, are incorrigibly dominating, right? That maybe they dominate to some extent, but it's possible to reform them in such a way as to make them either non-dominating or at least less dominating. If there is at least one instance of domination which could be shown to be morally justifiable, not just on balance, but in and of itself, this would severely undermine the traditional claims of anarchism. The same is true, albeit to a lesser extent, if one or more of the traditional objects of anarchist critique, for example, the state or capitalism, could be shown to be non-dominating, or at least capable of being made non-dominating in and of themselves. While it may be possible for one or both of these approaches to succeed, I do not believe that success is guaranteed or even easily attained. Anarchists have articulated compelling reasons to believe that domination and oppression are odious, not least of which that they appear incompatible with the morally valuable ends of individual freedom and social equality. This does not mean, of course, that they could not be morally justified in some instances, but it does suggest that any such justification would be the exception rather than the rule. The task of vindicating institutions, which anarchists have identified, is incorrigibly dominating, strikes me as arduous as well. It is difficult to imagine, for example, that sexism or racism could be anything other than dominating or oppressive. The same is true, albeit not as obviously, with regard to exploitative economic systems and opaque political authorities, including by hypothesis all known instances of the state. In these and many other cases besides, the burden is very clearly on those who would defend the moral legitimacy of such institutions, either by demonstrating that they are not in fact dominating, or else that their being dominating is compatible with their being morally legitimate. If it is true that anarchism levels a clear and unambiguous challenge to the state, capitalism, and the like, then those who would defend and advocate for these institutions cannot afford to dismiss anarchism out of hand. Okay, that's it.
We have time for about 20 minutes of questions. And before we start, I would just request that you keep your comments down to under 20 or 30 seconds before the question comes up. Okay? All
right. Well, throughout your talk, you didn't mention force. Now, I would regard that as a major point in determining domination. In other words, if it's domination with force or domination without force. I'm a libertarian, but it doesn't matter. But so where does force, is it necessary to have force to have domination, or can there be domination without force?
I talk a little bit about this in one of the sections that I sort of skipped over, the section over authority. But so recall that just the general definition of domination is a relationship in which one party prevents another party from participating in determining his or her actions or the conditions of his or her actions. That doesn't necessarily require force, right? In the sense of like physical coercion or something like that, right? You know, for example, it might be possible to just manipulate people into giving up their autonomy, right? Which would not require, you know, physical coercion, right? But on this view, that would be, you know, just as odious, right? Because, you know, just as a certain amount of moral culpability obviously attains to the dominator, it can also attain to the dominated to the extent that the dominated, you know, gives up his or her moral autonomy, right? In a way that, you know, in a situation which doing so is not required, right? Which would pretty much be every situation for a genuinely morally autonomous being. But typically the way that domination works, particularly in the case of opaque authorities, is by coercing people, right? So I would say in response to your question that it may be, you know, possible to have instances of domination that don't involve explicit or direct force, but generally they do. And that's part of the reason why they're odious.
Right.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good. Question. The gentleman back here.
Somebody might be a selective anarchist. Like, you might believe that the traffic laws are good because they protect people, but some other kind of laws, like the war on drugs, might not be good because they restrict personal choice. Comment on that?
Yeah, so this is kind of related to what I was talking about at the very end, for example, even if we're agreed that the state, just for example, is essentially dominating and thus bad, right? That doesn't mean that everything that the state does in every single instance is bad, right? So one could argue, for example, that like traffic laws, you know, in most instances at least, would be an example of something that the state does that makes sense and is arguably good for us, right? And so to that extent, I mean, as part of like a broader long-term strategy of combating domination, like anarchists could obey traffic laws, right? Or could concede that, you know, the value of people in general obeying them, right? But typically the way that, you know, a lot of arguments in favor of the moral legitimacy of the state work, right, is by saying, well, you know, the state provides us with all of these, you know, these social benefits, such as, you know, the safety and so forth that's afforded by traffic laws, right? Therefore, everything that the state does is justified in some sense, right? So if you're grateful for the safety the state provides you, then you need to shut up and just accept the war on drugs, for example, right? But I think that, you know, one of the points that comes out of anarchist critique is that, you know, it's possible to distinguish the state as a general sort of, you know, a kind of institution from all of the specific things that the state does, and be sort of like tactical in terms of, you know, the battles that one chooses, right, with respect to the state. If that makes sense.
Thanks. You mentioned the word practical atheists, practical anarchists.
Yeah.
And perhaps pragmatic anarchists. I wondered what you meant by that.
Right.
Could you give some examples?
So practical, the term practical anarchism in the literature is usually sort of a synonym for what's referred to as strong anarchism or political anarchism, right? And this is basically just the idea that recognizing that certain institutions such as the state are morally illegitimate also gives us a strong reason to work in some way to get rid of them and replace them with something else, right? And that's in contrast with, and by the way, that is the way that most anarchists in the tradition have sort of been, right? In addition to being sort of like critics of existing institutions, they've also worked in various ways to try to get rid of them and replace them with something else. It's a revolutionary tradition. But contemporary philosophical anarchists in the philosophical literature are very, very quick to point out that, you know, that they're just skeptical about the moral legitimacy of the state, and that the fact that the state might be illegitimate doesn't give us an all things considered reason to like become revolutionaries, right? So you know, basically the difference between like practical anarchism and just philosophical anarchism as it's talked about in the literature is that practical anarchists, you know, seek in various ways to, you know, ranging from, you know, peaceful ways to like violent ways to abolish or undermine the very institutions that they regard as oppressive. Whereas philosophical anarchists like, you know, Robert Wolf and stuff would not say that. They'd say there might be other, even though the state is illegitimate, there might be good practical or prudential reasons for us to stick with it.
What are you going to substitute for it?
That's a completely different question.
That's another question, yeah, is, I know, yeah. And it's a hard one.
It is.
There are three aspects to anarchism, mm-hmm. and that is the social, the political, and the economic. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful ideal, but it assumes that everyone who is born has the opportunity and the ability to have a good IQ and to understand and be educated. It cannot work really, unless you have a very high moral standard to start with. It's the goal of Marxism. It's the end. It's true communism. And unfortunately, you go through that, you have to go through that dictatorship, and that's terrible.
Right.
So that, in my own view, social, I'm very much a social anarchist. Mm-hmm. You know, stay out of my life, mm-hmm. my personal life,
right.
as long as I'm not hurting anybody else. But in the economic side of it, I want a strong political group to protect me mm-hmm. from bad medicines mm-hmm. and from cheats and liars and gunmen.
Right.
So that, like I said, we have not evolved high enough mm-hmm. to be anarchists. We've got a long way to go before we can be anarchists.
Okay, doctor.
So I'll be trying to think about how to sort of phrase this question, but it's like, what would be the, or had the anarchists proposed a form of organization or institution or replacements for, or you have some examples, because I think it certainly seems like they are critical, they're criticizing and wanting to do away with organizations, but in the long, I guess, because in the short term, they won't tolerate something. Mm-hmm. What would be the vision in the long term in terms of, I mean, is it conceivable in a planet with, you know, 7-8 billion people, mm-hmm. Would we minimize the number of institutions that we need, or would we, what would they fundamentally mm-hmm. be like?
Right.
If they involve, I mean, Bob was kind of alluding to
right.
people and their behavior, and
right.
intelligence and passion and so forth.
Right. Yeah. Well. First of all, so I'll just sort of speak to the sort of general response of the anarchist tradition to these kinds of concerns. I mean, to name just one example, like William Godwin, who was the wife of Mary Wollstone, excuse me, the husband of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Women, and the father of Mary Shelley. Godwin was you know, sort of took the classical liberal sort of critique of the state, you know, to its sort of logic, what he saw as a sort of logical limit, which, you know, is in kind of a kind of anarchism or statelessness. And, you know, Godwin sort of emphasizes the value of education, right? So on some level, he would agree that, like, it would be a disaster for people to go from, you know, from being under the yoke of the state to immediately being without it, right? Because we're so used to living, you know, under domination, right? So, you know, he argues, he's one of these sort of evolutionary anarchists who argues that over time, as people become progressively more educated and so on and so forth, that the state will become kind of like moribund, and it will just sort of disappear on its own, right? So anyway, that's just one. I mean, a lot of anarchists in the tradition are marked by a kind of, you know, extreme optimism, right? Some might even say naivete regarding the, you know, the improvability of the human race, right? You know, even while they acknowledge that, like, right now, you know, the human race as a whole has a long way to sort of go before anarchy would even be much of an option for us, right? And so there is kind of there's definitely an acknowledgement of that, right? The difference is, of course, that they think that it's a realizable sort of goal, right? Now, getting to the other question, I mean, the short answer is that anarchists imagine a form of social organization which doesn't involve coercive authority or domination or oppression, right? So you know, that's very vague, obviously, but in the anarchist literature, there's all kinds of different discussions and proposals about what a libertarian society might look like, right? And it's really kind of difficult to sort of, to provide a summary, but I mean, you know, one sort of common idea is that, you know, people, where decisions are sort of made now on the basis of, you know, the top-down sort of directive of a centralized political power, say, The anarchists imagine political institutions which are sort of directly democratic, right, where everybody sort of participates equally in the terms by which they will be sort of governed, if you like, right? And similar proposals are made with respect to economic production and consumption, right? So for example, instead of having a firm where you have the owner, right, who then hires people out for a wage to make stuff or whatever, and then, you know, on the classical Marxist model, you know, sort of arbitrarily scalps off a portion of their wages for purposes of accumulating profit, right? You would just have a productive enterprise in which the workers are also the owners, right? And so the workers would direct, you know, would compensate themselves equally and directly on the basis of their productive capacity, right? So basically, you eliminate the capitalist middleman, right? Is sort of the idea. So, I mean, there's kind of a rich body of anarchist theoretical literature, you know, including a lot of like interesting internecine sort of disagreements among the anarchists about, you know, what alternative institutions would look like. Now, of course, whether any of those institutions would actually work and how we would implement them, that's a different question entirely, right? But, you know, that discussion does exist.
You got into this area a little bit, but let's think about a scenario where you've got a group of people who voluntarily and freely enter into an association, and they agree on rules like we'll respect each other's property, we won't commit violence against each other, and, you know, if there is violence committed by one against another, we'll come to the defense of the victim and, you know, we'll restore property that's stolen and all that. Everybody signs up on that. And then somebody violates the rules. You know, can they just withdraw, you know, right before they're punished and say, oh, I no longer agree to these rules. You know, it's oppressive. You know, what you're doing to me to punish me for my past behavior is oppressive. Mm-hmm. You know, or how do you perpetuate that when new generations come along? I mean, does every child have to sign into it on their 12th birthday? And then, you know, if they don't choose to sign up, then are they just thrown out? I'm trying to vision how this...
Sounds like cults to me.
Where does the idea of, you know, given that Locke and Hobbes's, you know, political contracts are fictionalized, Where would there be room for an actual political contract that made sense in a self-governmental sense? Is there no room for that in anarchism?
It kind of depends. I mean, you know, there are some anarchists who would talk about, you know, sort of the basic political organization of an anarchist society in terms of contracts. But when you do that, and I think this is something that they're aware of, when you do that, you know, you run afoul some of the problems that beset like social contract theory more generally. You know, like for example, you know, like you say, you know, if there's even like a, you know, explicitly, if there's a contract that everybody has to explicitly consent to, then like, what do you deal, you know, how do you, you know, deal with kids that are born into that society and so forth? But I think that, you know, anarchists generally try to avoid that kind of language, and instead they talk about the idea of voluntary association and mutual aid, right? So people will agree on, as much as possible, like, people will try to avoid creating, like, abstract sort of policies and regulations and so forth that are intended to speak to, you know, future hypothetical situations, right? And instead to keep, you know, social policies and so forth as tied as much as possible to concrete sorts of situations. And all of those sorts of things need to be agreed to by everybody, right? And with the understanding that if for some reason they don't work, that people can, you know, get together and revise them at any time. But, I mean, you know, I take it that the sort of the heart of this question is sort of the traditional sort of, like, how do you deal with crime and punishment in an anarchist society sort of thing, right? And again, I would just say that that's the subject of a pretty rich literature, right? I mean, for example, some anarchists would say that, you know, the key is to find some way of dealing with, I mean, well, first of all, there's kind of an optimistic assumption that most of the conventional types of crime or antisocial behavior that exist in current society would disappear in an anarchist society because their motivation would be gone. But you would still, there's still always the possibility that people will just, you know, violate the principles that everybody's agreed to. And so what do you do in that case, right? Well, of course, the trick is finding some way to effectively deal with it that doesn't, you know, re-inscribe domination, right? And that's a very, difficult problem to deal with, right? You know, I take it that to the extent that a person's participation in that society, to the extent that a given person's ability to benefit from existing in society with others, right, is in the anarchist scheme or the communist scheme more generally, like a function of their willingness to participate, you know, to sort of, you know, go along with the ground rules that everybody set, right, then a person's failure to do that, right, is basically, for all intents and purposes, it's a sign on their part that they're no longer interested in receiving the benefits that accrue to people who belong to that society, in which case it would be totally appropriate for people to engage in some kind of shunning or something like that, right? You know, we're just not going to, like, play with you anymore, right? So if you want to, you know, you can go someplace else and you can work with those people, but we're just not going to, like, allow you to participate in our productive enterprises anymore or our assemblies or whatever, right, because you broke the rules or something. Now, I mean, you know, perhaps there's some sense in which that's still, like, you know, a reinscription of domination or something, but I'm not sure. I mean, I think that, you know, there's probably ways that we could create, like, an enforcement mechanism or something for the things that we agree on that doesn't involve, like, violent coercion. I'm not sure. It is a real problem. I mean, I can see that.
Thank you. I guess I was wondering if we can... what I love most about anarchist thought is it's, like, discussions on freedom. But freedom is very complicated, and it's not just political or economic, but it can also be psychological freedom. You know, so you might... like Lacan talks a lot about the unconscious and how he kind of reifies the unconscious as, like, to give an example, if I see a bag that's just laying there and I could steal it, I might think, oh, someone would judge me. Well, who is that person that would judge me? Well, it's just like a figment of my unconscious, right, my imagination. And so I think there are lots of examples, even like theologians or like drug users who can talk about how freedom, you can be free in an economic sense, maybe in a political sense, but not free at all in a psychological sense. And so I was wondering how much the anarchist literature engages with freedom in a psychological sense. You know, you can have the post-structuralists who talk about how you don't realize you're not free, you know, because you just don't think of other options, and they invoke a lot of times these, like, the event, you know, from that view or whatever, but some kind of ontological basis that you can get outside of the system to gain freedom.
Right.
But I hadn't read any of that in the anarchist literature that I've read. And I was also thinking about... I just lost it. I don't know, I guess I'll just stop with that. But, like, how to... I guess with your practical anarchism, it just came to me. If we're talking about living anarchy, you know, in, like, our society, do we have any from, like, the BDSM community? Like, they do have these very strict, like, here's what we accept, here's what we don't accept, and if you mess that up, you're not playing with us, like, ever again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they... So, if we're talking about practical anarchy, where are the, like, real results instead of these, like, hypothetical examples?
Right, right. Okay, so there's two really sort of interesting questions there. One is... you know, what is the scope of of critique in anarchism? Well, I mean, I think that actually one of the things that kind of distinguishes the anarchism of the 19th and early 20th centuries, for example, from contemporaneous Marxism and also liberalism is precisely a more expansive view of freedom, right? So for example, like the Marxists around the First International tend to understand freedom solely in economic terms, right? Whereas, you know, like 18th and 19th century liberal thinkers, you know, from Locke to Rousseau to Mill, typically understand freedom in political terms, right? But, I mean, one of the great contributions of anarchist thinkers, like, here's a great example. Somebody mentioned Emma Goldman earlier. In her 1910 collection of essays that's called, appropriately enough, Anarchism and Other Essays, right, She has several essays that deal specifically with what we would now recognize as like psychological oppression, right? And oftentimes, it's in the context of sexual oppression that she's talking about these sorts of things, right? So you know, for one of Goldman's great critiques of the liberal sort of feminists of her time was that, you know, that they understood women's oppression solely in terms of the lack of political rights of various kinds, right? But where in fact the oppression of women runs much deeper than that. So there are discussions. I mean, they're much richer in some places than in others. I mean, like Emma Goldman would be a great example of somebody who discusses this. But actually, that is something that's, in my view, sort of separates the classical anarchists from their contemporaries. And of course, as the tradition has continued, like you have a lot of people, you mentioned post-structuralism, a lot of people have argued that there's a way of reading at least certain post-structuralists as anarchists, right?
Yeah.
And if that's true, right, then one of the benefits would be that, you know, the post-structuralists have a sort of more expansive sort of, you know, view of not just oppression, you know, in general, but sort of the mechanisms of oppression, right? And so it kind of could serve as a, you know, so like Foucault or whatever could serve as a kind of corrective or a supplement to like Bakunin or something like that. But the second question is, I mean, that's another like really broad question. I mean, there's a classic book that came out in the 60s by a guy named Colin Ward, who was a longtime, you know, anarchist sort of revolutionary. He passed away very recently. Called Anarchy in Action, right? And the whole point of that book is to show that anarchy is sort of a part of everyday life. That we don't have to actually look very far for examples of anarchy, right? So he uses the same example of people queuing up politely for a bus, right? You know, human beings have the capacity to sort of spontaneously order ourselves without, you know, without external coercion, right? And so if it's possible for us to engage in, you know, fairly non-reflective forms of non-coercive social coordination, right, then that at least opens up the possibility that we could organize an entire society that way, right? That's sort of his point. But I think more, you know, more generally, like, one could look to examples of, like, you know, definitely of like, alternative subaltern cultures and stuff like that, in which traditional, you know, sort of mechanisms of oppression or whatever are, you know, if not completely absent, at least sort of like problematized in some way. The S&M thing is interesting, but you know, you could also look to, for example, like the traditional sort of workers' culture in this country of, you know, the late 19th, late 20th century, where there's this like sort of this holistic attempt on the part of workers to create like an alternative workers' culture that exists alongside the capitalist culture. So you have these workers like, you know, creating their own institutions, their own, you know, sort of publishing outfits, their own newspapers. They're, you know, putting on plays and musicals and all this sort of stuff, right? And so they're kind of like creating the world that they want to see in microcosm, you know, in the midst of capitalism, right? And so the industrial workers of the world very famously said that our goal is to create the new world in the shell of the old, right? And part of that for like the Wobblies was the creation of like counter, you know, sort of like counterpublics, right? So there are examples of this.
Okay, I have time for two more questions. This gentleman here, if there's someone who hasn't asked a question, then we'll go with that person. Otherwise, we can go with you, Craig.
Two more questions. Yes, hi. I like the, my question is almost asked a couple of times, but since people can withdraw and form their own communities, and people have done that repeatedly in England and America, and you've got people like, I think the father of Mary Louise Alcott forms a little community, and it didn't succeed, and I think the Benthamites formed some. And I think today, probably the most cohesive and lasting communities tend to be religiously based, mm-hmm. maybe cultish, but religiously based. But has there been any communities that have formed and lasted for any noticeable period of time, mm-hmm. where they proclaim themselves as anarchists and try to follow anarchist mm-hmm. Principles? I mean, you could say somebody who's a socialist is an anarchist, but I mean, they actually come out and say, we are anarchists. Or were they like socialists,
right?
And then the anarchists were blended in. But were there examples? Have people studied them? Just practical examples of anarchy in action?
Yeah. So, quickly, somebody asked us about, somebody asked me about this earlier, and so there's sort of two, you know, sort of kinds of examples we could point to. Like, one is, you know, is actually existing or historically existing societies, right, which seem to evince to greater or lesser extent, you know, a lot of the features that we associate with anarchism, right? This is something, admittedly, that I'm not all that familiar with, except in passing, but there are, for example, there's an anthropologist named Harold Barclay, there's another anthropologist named David Graeber, and they've written about the extent to which, you know, there are certain cultures that, you know, that anthropologists used to refer to as primitive or indigenous or whatever, right, that, you know, that are at least anarchistic, right? And so that, and in fact, you know, Barclay goes so far as to say that anarchy was the predominant form of human social organization for like the first, like, you know, what, like 200,000 years of our existence, or, you know, or whatever, right? Until, you know, the state appears in ancient Mesopotamia, right? But as far as like it's historical examples of people saying, okay, we're anarchists and now we're going to organize an anarchist sort of community or something like that, they're few and far between, but they, you know, the three examples I always point people to would be the Paris Commune in the 1870s, the Spanish Civil War during the 1930s, and the Free Republic of the Ukraine in the 1920s. And in all three of those cases, you have, you know, people who for, you know, I mean, often not longer than a couple of years, I mean, at best, right, managing to, you know, to construct, you know, albeit a sort of nascent sort of form, the kind of society that like Kropotkin or whatever talks about. In the case of like the Spanish Civil War, the problem there, for example, is arguably that the Spanish anarchists in Catalonia were simultaneously fighting a war against the fascists, right? And it's very, very hard to build a utopia while simultaneously fighting a war against fascists, being double-crossed by the Soviets, right? And by the way, these anarchist militias, of course, didn't have they didn't have traditional sort of military discipline, right? So they were experimental. I mean, arguably, that's not the best time to experiment with alternative military sorts of institutions, like when you're trying to defend your country from a fascist coup, right? So arguably, the reason why, like, the Barcelona Commune, like, fell apart was because, you know, it just was overrun by the fascists, or by Franco. In the, yeah, totally bad timing. And in the case of the Free Army of the Ukraine, I mean, you may not have heard this, but like in the aftermath of the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution, remember that the Russian Revolution was a team effort, right? A lot of people think that it was like the Bolsheviks, you know, it was actually the Bolsheviks with a bunch of left-wing allies, right? Including anarchists.
Yeah.
And in Russia, you know, once the Bolsheviks came to power, right, they basically like rounded up all of the non-Bolshevik leftists and executed them or sent them to gulags, right? But there were some far-flung places like northeastern Ukraine, for example, where anarchists managed for a time anyway to stay out from underneath the thumb of the Bolsheviks. And there was a guy in the Ukraine named Nestor Makhnov who kind of led, you know, this sort of anarchist army called the Black Army of the Ukraine and fought with the Red Army and also the White Army for like 4 years, right? Meanwhile, you know, the people of the Free Territories, as they were called, right, were basically creating an anarcho-syndicalist sort of experiment, right? And in that case, too, it failed not because of any sort of internal contradictions or whatever, but because the Free Territories were eventually overrun by the Red Army, right? And the same thing with the French Commune. You know, the French army came back from the Franco-Prussian War, surrounded Paris, and killed everyone. Right? And sent the survivors to like Devil's Island and stuff like that. So it's kind of hard to know whether those experiments would have succeeded if they, you know, if they had been carried out in somewhat more hospitable conditions, right? I mean, maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't have, right? The problem with people trying to set up like alternative institutions is that they're surrounded on all sides by the status quo. And oftentimes the status quo has a vested interest in making sure that their experiment doesn't succeed, right? So and that's tended to be the case with, you know, the past 200 plus years of like revolutionary experimentation.
So we're about out of time. One last question. What you were talking about there is as far as what's the practicality of this thought process in today and moving forward society when you have a just
every type of individual that you can think of now, plus ones you can't even think of. And we can't even all agree on anything at any given time. How can you basically possibly make something that seems more of a wishful thinking aspect than an actual practical system of use? Because, like I said, I'm not like anybody in this room. Nobody's like each other. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you're not going to get all of us to agree on something. And then you can also look on the overly politically correct system that we live in now, where somebody can say something derogatory towards one person, and everybody shuns the individual, even though it's that individual's freedom to say what he wants. Why should he be shunned? You know, right. It's like, even, you know, it just seems like it's a self-corrupting system,
right?
Because you're giving up certain rules for other certain rules, only because you all agree that those rules seem less repressive than this set of rules. But then who's to say that those rules that you choose aren't going to repress somebody else, and then we're going to spiral in?
Right. Well, I mean, just really quickly, I mean, of course, you can't say that in advance, right?
Right.
And of course, nor can you necessarily say in advance what a workable sort of... I mean, one of the things that the anarchist tradition always emphasizes is the importance of experimentation, right? So instead of like creating like utopian blueprints and planned economies and that sort of thing, like we have a sort of like loose sense of what we want, and then we experiment with different kinds of living to see what works, right? And so, you know, the idea is that nobody would have to, you know, that if society were sort of, you know, sort of radically reconfigured in a way that prioritizes small groups of people, that reprioritizes like the local as the sort of the fundamental unit of social organization rather than like the nation state or some other like ginormous institution, that it would be much easier for people who, for whatever reason, don't get along with the people with whom they're living to just go to some other commune, right?
Basically say, shift the power from the upper...
Right, horizontally to the localities, yeah. But, you know, in response to the more general question, I mean, you know, let me just say quickly that, I mean, this is something that anarchists have argued with each other about vehemently and sometimes, you know, kind of viciously, as long as there have been anarchists, right? So, you know, there's anarchists who have traditionally been referred to as insurrectionary anarchists, right? And you still see these people on TV from time to time, right? You know, they're the people dressed in black, like ninjas, you know, who like break, you know, windows and light cop cars on fire. Well, they've always been around. Like in the 19th century, they were even more hardcore. They would assassinate kings and blow up train stations and stuff, right? But their basic idea is that, you know, we form small, like, revolutionary cells that engage in acts of, like, you know, extreme violence, right? And that these acts will serve as a kind of, like, propaganda that will awaken the oppressed masses from their slumber, right? And they'll be like, yes, I'm going to burn a cop car too, sort of thing. Of course, that never happens, right? Instead, you know, anarchism just gets even more marginalized in the media and stuff, and they get called terrorists. There's another tradition, or sort of set of traditions, that would say that the process of revolution needs to be more organic than that. And it's probably true, for example, that you can't, and it would be inadvisable to try to reach everybody at once, right? And so you try to find some particular segment of society that, you know, is particularly, you'll reasonably be sort of particularly open to the general sort of idea of anarchist critique. And traditionally, anarchists, a lot of anarchists have located that in the working classes, right? And so, you know, there's a group of there's an orientation in anarchism called anarcho-syndicalism, which tries to agitate through the labor unions, right? And so, you know, to try to, you know, to sort of bring, like, workers around to anarchist ideas on the basis of you know, their on-the-ground experiences, right? And so depending upon how, like, successful, like, these efforts are in the labor movement, right, then you can also, you know, perhaps simultaneously or at some later point, like, move into other sorts of, you know, the old sort of communist term for this is burrowing from within, right? So, you dispatch, you know, savvy anarchists to different sort of oppressed sectors of society, right, where they start to preach the gospel of anarchism, right? And then over time, you know, people sort of, like, become, you know, sort of enlightened or whatever. That's you know, one way in which these things are discussed.
Okay, let's give a round of applause to Dr. Levine. We'll be back in 2 weeks, Tuesday, April 9th. Dr. Dan Levine with UTA will be speaking on emotional partners, not options.